As a former counter-terrorism officer serving in Asia, Somerset-based author Philip Tucker has used his experiences for the basis of his second novel, The Jasmine Sari, available now on Amazon. With over 30 years as a detective and a counter-terrorism consultant, Philip injects a police perspective into this terrorism thriller. Philip says this book is different and that it focuses on the mantra that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. The action is examined from both points of view. Seasoned London anti-terror cop Alex Cadman is sent to Bangladesh to share his experience with local police officers. He thinks his days of working on terrorist investigations are long gone, but he soon finds himself embroiled in an investigation that's a race against time. Can he identify the terrorists before tragedy strikes? The Jasmine Sari by Philip Tucker is available now on Amazon, free on Kindle if you sign up to Amazon Unlimited. Philip tells me that advertising The Jasmine Sari on London Calling has had a big impact on book sales and led to some great new reviews. So Philip is now looking for an agent and a publisher. If you're an agent or a publisher interested in working with Philip, you can contact him directly on Philip Tucker Author, all one word, at btinternet.com. That's Philip Tucker Author at btinternet.com if you're an agent or publisher seeking to sign an independent author with proven commercial success.
This is London Calling.
London Calling.
There's pictures of a hand around my neck, and that is the security saying that he knew that if I totally hit the floor, you become not a human anymore. It's not like someone punching in the face. If you're a body on the floor, the police agreed, every police officer I've talked to agreed in New Zealand that I was lucky to be alive.
Welcome to London Calling with me, James Dellingpole, and my very good friend, Mr. Toby Young. Tobes, I've got nothing to tell you this week. I've been having this sort of, it's like being in a desert of meaninglessness, because I was so resigned to the fact that I was going to die in the hunting season that I wasn't really expecting this lease of life or this void. As I look, I wait until next November, which is when it all kicks off again. I'm not even sure they're going to be alive then.
So you're now so devoted to hunting, it's become such a central part of your life that you feel almost as though life has ended when the hunting season ends and now won't begin again until November.
Well, it's what it has to do with, I mean, look, everyone goes to hell in the manner of their choosing. And it's about adrenaline, really, isn't it? Adrenaline and camaraderie. I have no social life, really, outside the hunting field. I'm not really interested in talking to people when I'm not on a horse, frankly. And I miss the adrenaline buzz. It's just like... I mean, you get this from war correspondents, don't you? When they come back from war zones and they just miss the buzz.
You know, do you think you might be suffering from PTSD? Curiously, one of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder is paranoia. So maybe one of the reasons you are prone to lapping up these paranoid conspiracy theories is actually just a symptom of the PTSD, the post-traumatic stress disorder you suffer in virtue of riding.
Yeah, Tobes, that would be it. That's really insightful. Well done, mate.
Yeah, I think I've cracked it, James.
I'm so impressed the way that you managed to segue in from hunting into I don't want to believe in conspiracy theories because they are too scary and the CIA has told me not to. Nice one, Tobes.
Listen, I wrote down something which I wanted to run past you, which I thought was quite a strong rebuttal of the notion that Bill Gates has been pulling the strings behind the scenes because he has this depopulation agenda. And I just wanted to get your reaction to it. It's not particularly mean-spirited. And it's by a blogger called Eugypius, who we republish
sometimes.
I know
Eugypius. You know Eugypius. The guy who's in denial. He wants to go so far but no further because it's too scary. Like a lot of you people.
I think he sits somewhere between Team James and Team Toby, but probably closer to Team Toby than Team James, certainly on the role of Bill Gates in the events of the last 3 years. So this was what he said. He said, I would observe that theories of Gates and the vaccines must be brought into alignment with several basic facts. Vaccination rates across Africa and the Third World are truly dismal. Gates himself has repeatedly criticized the mRNA vaccines for their inability to stop transmission, and the Earth's population has continued to increase since the pandemic began, undaunted by all public health policies. If the plan is indeed depopulation via the mass administration of pharmaceuticals, we can take some solace in the boundless idiocy of our shadowy overlords. Yeah. What do you say to that, James? Well, I mean, if it is Bill Gates' plan, it doesn't seem to be going very well.
I don't think it demonstrates much other than, of course, the powers that be, the cabal, the predator class, whatever. I mean, they're going to have these plans, but no plan survives contact with the enemy. So the fact that he wasn't able to get such traction in Africa, despite having probably helped inspire or even been involved with the bumping off of people like President Magufuli of Tanzania, who opposed the vaccines, the fact that
died of COVID, not bumped off.
Oh yeah, right. He died of COVID. Of course, he did, Tobes. So the fact that they couldn't persuade people in Africa, who, after all, you know, people still live in remote villages in Africa, and also Africans have bitter experience of Bill Gates's vaccination programs, which end up killing more people than they save, if they save any lives at all. So I don't think that Africa's reluctance to get death jabs is a prima facie case for showing that Bill Gates is not trying to depopulate the world. It's that these are non sequiturs.
Well, one of the reasons more vaccines weren't available in developing countries was because they were diverted. Vaccines intended for developing countries were diverted by Western political leaders who wanted to hog what they believed were these very effective vaccines for themselves. There's something in the WhatsApp exchanges in the lockdown files in which Matt Hancock,
if you believe those,
is seen to try to divert some vaccines intended for the developing world to the UK. So it's not the reluctance of, you know, sceptical Africans to take the vaccine that has retarded the vaccine rollout in Africa. It's the lack of availability of the mRNA vaccines in Africa. I mean, I think that's.
I think that point remains unproven, doesn't it? You're stating something that in these possibly concocted WhatsApp messages, which I'm sceptical of anyway, but supposing they're true, supposing they are accurate, well, you're just saying that the lucky Africans dodged a bullet because idiot Western politicians decided that they would hog the doses that were going to go to Africa, but it doesn't demonstrate that. Had this not been the case, Africans all across the continent would have been queuing up to have these death shots. I don't think they would.
Maybe not, but fact that people like Hancock, who I understood you believe to be essentially
Hancock,
puppets of the WEF, and people like Bill Gates, why are they trying to divert vaccines intended for the developing world to the Western world, when if your object is to depopulate the world, surely you'd start in developing
You're
countries.
Really, really obsessed with this. This is your killer argument, isn't it, Toby? That either it is Bill Gates, his grand plan is to depopulate the world, and if he doesn't, if he doesn't, then he's failed. It's, as I said before, no plan survives contact with the enemy. Of course, there are going to be cock-ups on the way, which enable people like you to say, "Oh, it's all just incompetent ministers, and there's nothing planned about it." It means this, none of this stuff means anything. It's just your coat mechanisms for trying to justify what is actually rather sinister and horrible.
Just on the Telegraph being bought and paid for. I mean, if the Telegraph was bought and paid for, James, how come it published regularly people like Shinetra Gupta and Carl Hennigan and Martin Kuldorf?
Just occasionally.
How come it sometimes published me?
Tokenism.
Liam Halligan and Alison Pearson podcast.
Yeah. People who were prepared to operate within the terms of the Overton window, which was certainly not people like me.
I think it's coverage of the government's
pandemic. Of course you do.
Was more even-handed than any of the other broadsheets.
Of course you
And
did.
They certainly did give a platform to skeptics, including people who were skeptical about vaccinating children, like Molly Kingsley of Us for Them.
By Molly Kingsley, and this has been your champion example ever since, because you love it, because it proves that the Telegraph was really, really critical of what was going on. I don't think so.
Well, it doesn't prove that they were necessarily more critical than they were accepting, but it does prove that they weren't bought and paid for, which is what you said 5 minutes ago. Anyway, listeners who are interested in this debate about the veracity of the lockdown files, or whether it was part of what you still believe is some kind of conspiracy to persuade us, now they're conspiring to persuade us it wasn't a conspiracy. Readers who are interested in that question will have an opportunity to hear me interview Isabel Oakeshott, who released the WhatsApp messages to the Telegraph, on stage at the Emanuel Centre. I'm taking a leaf out of your book, James. We've organised a live event at the Emanuel Centre on June the 3rd. Doors open at 7, from 8 till 10. And in addition to me interviewing Isabel on stage about the lockdown files, we're going to have some dramatised readings of some of the more sensational exchanges with actors playing Matt Hancock and Dominic Cummings and Boris Johnson.
This is mine
and Isabel's idea. But tickets will go on sale on April the 8th, and we'll put up a link to how people can register to be notified when the tickets go on sale at the bottom of the podcast page on Ricochet. But I've just been in the process of organising this, setting it up, getting some flyers done, and trying to emulate your own successes in various respects, James. I've been told by one of your collaborators that it's better to announce when tickets will go on sale rather than put tickets on sale immediately, to build up some anticipation and a bit of excitement and hubbub about the forthcoming event. Anyway, James, you are clearly a marketing genius, given that you sold out the Emanuel Centre within a couple of weeks and sold 900 seats. So you may have an opportunity to crow about lack of ticket sales to mine and Isabel's event in due course. But tickets will go on sale on April 8th, and it's going to take place on June 3rd at the Emanuel Centre.
I wouldn't experience any schadenfreude if you sold no tickets, Tobes. I wish you well. It's tough making a living in this kind of crazy world we live in. So good luck.
Should we hear from one of our sponsors, James? I think it's your turn.
See if you can guess who this advert is from. Oh, it's headlined "Personal Note from Thor." So there's the giveaway. Hey there, fellow caller. What I'm going to share with you now is one of many Thor, please keep me anonymous, but LinkedIn messages that I've received since the world went mad in March 2020. This message is from a director of an energy services business who went on to engage me, that's Thor, in developing his team's strategic presentation capability. Thor, I've watched and read your posts. I think you are about as spot on for a non-brainwashed dummy as a regular soul can be. We are being hoaxed daily. I cannot often like comment because the world has indeed been hoaxed, and I still need to work closely with guys who are absolutely lost. If you or your business might benefit from an advisor who's very much not brainwashed, someone who will help you create a positive mental framework and then take useful action no matter how lost the world may be, let's talk. The first step is to connect with me, linkedin.com/in/Thorholt, or WhatsApp me, 447906321593. Skull Thor. P.S. Please do connect, even if you don't need my services, because I'd like to stay in touch with you, my fellow London caller. LinkedIn.com/in/Thor Holt.
So, James, last week I went on a little mini break with Caroline. We went to Marbella for two nights. And it was at the invitation of the owner of the British International School of Marbella, who wanted me to talk to year 11s and sixth formers about free speech. He put us up at this very nice hotel on the beach. we went out to supper with my cousin's son, who lives in Gibraltar. I hadn't realised that Gibraltar was so close. It's only about a 45-minute drive from Marbella. But had a really nice time. It was great to be in the sunshine, particularly as we've had such a dismal spring here in England. So it was a lovely sort of two-day break, but nice to get away. And you don't have to be vaxxed to go to Spain anymore. So, no problem.
Did you get any kind of shedding from Gibraltar? Because, I mean, like, Gibraltar is one of the most jabbed up places on earth, isn't it? Gibraltar and the Seychelles, I think, are about the worst.
Yes. We once ran a piece, actually, citing, I think, the spike in infections in Gibraltar, in spite of it being one of the most vaccinated regions of the world, as evidence that the mRNA vaccine did not prevent you from infecting other people. And there was kind of, what's it called? Vaccine escape. It was denounced by the then First Minister of Gibraltar in the Gibraltarian Parliament. One of the Daily Skeptics, or was it then, was the Lockdown Skeptics' finest hours.
Yeah. That's one of the things I've been trying to do. I've been trying to plan a holiday. It's hard. Because apart from anything else, one doesn't know how many holidays one is going to have before one either gets offed by the evil cabal or prevented from traveling by their master plan, which is, it's very clear. That if you look at the fires document, I think it's called, that there are plans to close most of Britain's airports by 2030 and stop us traveling. That is the game plan, and it's the same all over the world. And it's a bit depressing, really. I mean, it's quite difficult to explain to one's normie friends when they say, oh, well, there's always, we can always go next year or the year after. Well, will we be able to? I'm not sure we will.
I sometimes worry when I hear you talk like that, that you're making yourself depressed by catastrophizing in this way and imagining that you have less control over your life than you really do. There was an interesting piece, actually, by Jonathan Haidt, whose next book is going to be about the negative impact of social media and smartphones on Gen Z. And it's, the kind of data point that he's trying to explain is, why is Gen Z so susceptible to mental illness? Why is there this mental health crisis amongst kind of young people, particularly young women? And he wrote this book called The Coddling of the American Mind, in which they kind of explored this a little bit, but it's going to be the only subject, I think, of his next book. And he co-wrote that with Greg Lukianoff, who suffered a depressive episode at one point and was hospitalized and was able to come out of it because he did a course of cognitive behavioral therapy. And building on Greg's insight, Jonathan Haidt's hypothesis is that the reason we have a generation of young people who are suffering from unusual levels of depression is because they are being exposed to the opposite, what he calls reverse CBT, at universities and on social media platforms that they frequent. So CBT teaches you three sort of basic lessons. The first is stop catastrophizing. The second is stop engaging in emotional reasoning. And the third is you aren't as at the mercy of these external forces as you're imagining. You can control aspects of your life. The locus of control can be within your grasp. And universities, obviously, insofar as they've been captured by the woke cult and most social media platforms that particularly women are on, which is why women, he thinks, suffer from more mental ill health than young men in the same demographic. They teach them to catastrophize, whether about the environment, about their future, about the pandemic. One of the reasons that young people believe that the government should have been stricter. I mean, that was the extraordinary finding in a couple of recent polls, that young Britons actually think the government should have been much stricter during the pandemic and been place us under an even more constrained form of house arrest than the government did, much more so than older demographics, curiously, even though they were more adversely affected by it and less at risk from the virus. So they catastrophize. They've been taught to catastrophize by universities and social media. They engage in emotional reasoning. They're taught to prioritize their lived experience, whatever that is, over evidence and data. And they also imagine that they are at the mercy of these forces beyond their control, whether it be white supremacy or the patriarchy. They believe that if they walk past a statue of a slaver or a colonialist like Cecil Rhodes, it's going to traumatize them. It's going to have this kind of evil eye-like impact. It's going to enervate them and sap their energy. All kind of nonsense. But they've been taught reverse CBT, which is why they're suffering from depression. And sometimes when I hear you talk, it sounds like you've kind of bought into this kind of reverse CBT too. You catastrophize, you engage in emotional reasoning, and you imagine that all these dark forces, these satanic forces that are beyond your control are kind of, affecting you. You're at the mercy of them. Do you sometimes think that could be? Have you ever looked at CBT as a possible cure for your own?
While you're busy diagnosing my accurate concerns about the future as mental illness, I was just looking up this website called UKFires.org. UKFires is a collaboration between the University of Cambridge, Oxford, Nottingham, Bath, and Imperial College London. We are funded by the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council, which is the main funding body for engineering and physical sciences research in the UK. So this is an organization which is producing research, sort of blue sky thinking for government policy to do with net zero. Are you saying that this site and this statement by its director, Professor Julian Allward, delivering on the UK's commitment to zero emissions in 2050, did I just conjure this up from my depressed imagination? Did I just imagine that they have produce this document in which they say that by 2030, most of the major airports in the UK will be closed down. You say that it's only my negative thinking which is getting in the way of my traveling. But surely a more likely thing to get in the way of my traveling is if I cannot catch a plane anymore because all the airplanes have been grounded and all the airports closed. You seem to be at odds with reality, odds with evidence. It's all very well waving it away, saying, oh, it's mental illness. And by the way, here's a book that I've heard of by Jonathan Haidt. But it doesn't actually address the key issue of there is a plan for a great reset. There is a plan called for net zero. It is embedded in UK government policy, in fact, in government policy around the world. And I think to bury your head in the sand and go, oh, actually, you're just crazy, is not really addressing the issue.
Well, I don't think you're crazy for imagining that there is a net zero agenda and there are various climate activists, sometimes in key positions at important institutions, who have a kind of net zero agenda.
And in the government itself, Tobes.
And in the government itself.
All the government are on board with this.
Well, I don't think that's a paranoid fantasy. But interestingly, I think that the support for net zero is partly fueled by the catastrophizing which people who sign up to these various utopian agendas have been engaging in. But I do think that your sense that the closure of Britain's airports by, what did you say, 2030 is inevitable because some people are arguing for it. I think that is an example, I think, of imagining that we have less control over our
lives. These are government-funded bodies. I'm not talking about activists.
Let me give you an example, James.
Activists that are funded as well by the government. But
let me give you an example of why I think you're being too pessimistic, too fatalistic about the closure of airports. Did you see that there was a referendum in the city of Berlin in Germany yesterday? And they were asked to vote on whether to bring forward the date at which the city of Berlin becomes carbon neutral. And I think the current date is something like 2046. And they were voting whether to bring it forward, massively accelerate it. So I think within the next 10 years. And it was firmly rejected. at the ballot box. So doesn't look like Berlin Airport will be closing, at least not before 2046. So, you know, of course, there are people out there with an agenda to close airports, and that may impede your ability to travel. But it's not inevitable, James. You can do something about it.
These people are the Conservative government that you repeatedly brown nose and support because you want them to be your friends. And I'm saying that you should cut loose from these people because they're not Conservatives. They don't represent your interests. Why do you give them credit? Why do you respect them in any way? Then it's all very well saying, oh, there's a few activist groups out there floating these crazy ideas. This is embedded in government policy, just like 15-minute cities are embedded in government policies, just like this transition from petrol-driven cars, which they're about to make. You know, you won't be able to buy them anymore. This transition to electric cars, which we don't have enough electric points to charge. All these measures are actually policy of this government, which you repeatedly support and you seem very reluctant to criticize. I don't get it. All these people, everyone at cabinet level is on board with this stuff. It's not just Greta Thunberg and her crazes.
Well, you mentioned 15-minute cities. I don't think the government is promoting 15-minute cities. 15-minute cities have been promoted by local authorities. But Rishi Sunak's actually said that there may be a case for government intervention to stop local authorities imposing, you know, traffic calming measures, which are unpopular with the public and which they haven't voted for. And I don't think that, you know, the emergence of 15-minute cities is inevitable. I think there's been quite an encouraging pushback against the 15-minute city plan, certainly in Oxford, in Canterbury, in other parts of the country. So I don't think that's inevitable. Nor do I think it's inevitable that, you know, our airports will close by 2030. And I don't think that's government policy at the moment either. So I think you have a tendency to catastrophize and imagine these things are just inevitable.
I've drawn your attention, if you haven't seen it already, to the wonderful thing that's sort of gone viral on social media of Sandy Adams addressing I think Glastonbury Town Council and explaining to these people who are kind of feeling generally warm towards the notion of these wonderful cities where people can walk to all the shops they need within 15 minutes and there'll be no more congestion and stuff. And she explains to them that no, 15-minute cities is a top-down plan, which has been planned since at least the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. It's part of a long-term agenda by the people I call the predator class, whatever you want, the powers that be, the cabal, that they want to keep us penned into these like prison cells. I mean, in Bath, the different districts are literally called cells. And yeah, I mean, there may be some resistance, but the game plan all over the world is the same. This is top-down stuff. This is being planned at a supranational level. And unless people wake up to the fact that this is not a grassroots initiative, this is not what people want, and it's not going to be something people are going to enjoy or benefit from, then these things will go ahead. In the same way that HS2 went ahead, regardless of what... You remember how many reports came out about how HS2 was completely unnecessary. It wasn't going to make any difference to Britain's transport infrastructure other than, you know, shortening the journey from Birmingham to London by maybe 20 minutes. But there was no desire or need for it. And yet HS2 went ahead because the governing class was just following orders. In the same way, you've reported on the very interesting, maybe we'll talk about this in the next section, the Global Warming Policy Foundation has produced this very damning report, one of several it's produced over the years, into wind turbines by an Oxford Cambridge Oxford.
He's a physicist and
a physics professor anyway. So he's a proper hard science. So he probably has an idea of what's real and what's not real. Damning about wind turbines. But maybe we should talk about that after the next ad.
Let's do that. So it's my turn. Let's do a plug for Sal Deher, CFA, who listens to us in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Listeners, check out Sal's podcast, Angel Invest Boston. It's mostly on building technology startups, but it's not all about business. Sal also delves into other aspects of human flourishing, such as creativity, good relationships, and healthy aging. Curious about digital health and good eats? You might enjoy Sal's interview with his brother-in-law, startup founder Martin Aboitis, titled Healthcare and Paella. The webpage for the episode has a picture of the delectable paella Martin cooked the night before the interview, though images of the bottles of Rioja wine that accompanied the paella have been suppressed. Do follow Angel Invest Boston on your podcast app and leave a rating and a written review to help it get found. That's Angel Invest Boston. Yes, so this is an excellent piece of research published by the Global Warming Policy Foundation on the absolute idiocy of imagining that our energy needs currently provided by oil and gas can be replaced by wind turbines.
Wind.
And he makes a variety of very effective points. One is that the wind speed has to essentially be within this kind of Cinderella-like, Goldilocks-like window. And if it's above or if it's below, then they don't generate anything like as much electricity as we need. And if it's above, then they burn out and don't work, so have to be switched off. That's one point. Another point is that the batteries we'd need to create in order to store the power when the wind is blowing, so we could then use it when the wind stops blowing, is just absolutely enormous. It would be, you know, at a conservative estimate, something like the gross national product of the United States spent on just batteries alone, and the area which these batteries would have to sit in order to serve this purpose is kind of, you know, hundreds of square miles. So lots of really good points about.
Can I read my favorite bit from there? Because I've got it in front of me. It is, if the wind speed is 10 meters per second, about 20 miles an hour, the power is 600 watts per square meter at 100% efficiency. That means to deliver the same power as Hinkley Point C, that's the new nuclear power station, by wind would require 5.5 million square meters of turbine swept area. That should be quite unacceptable to those who care about birds and to other environmentalists. But the performance of wind is much worse than that, as a look at the simple formula shows. Because the power carried by the wind depends on the third power of the wind speed, if the wind drops to half speed, the power available drops by a factor of 8. So in other words, these turbines have got to be running at maximum capacity. Otherwise, if it drops a bit, the actual energy produced decreases exponentially. So almost worse, if the wind speed doubles, the power delivery goes up 8 times. And as a result, the turbine has to be turned off for its own protection. So, yeah, if it's slightly too, as you said, slightly too windy or not windy enough, these blades, these bat-chomping, bird-slicing eco-crucifixes cease to be any good at all. It's outrageous. But so my point, which I never feel you push far enough, but it's true, is that we've had this has been common knowledge to anyone who's looked into wind turbines for the last, couple of decades. I've been writing about it. The late Christopher Booker used to write about it all the time. What effect has this had on government policy? It's zero. I mean, less than zero. They go through with this stuff like they went through with HS2, like they're going through with net zero, like they're going through with the war on petrol cars, like they're going through with this electric car thing. That they do not care anymore what we think. They carry on regardless. The democratic process is broken. These are not answerable to the people.
Well, I agree that there does seem to be an unnerving degree of cross-party consensus about the pursuit of replacing oil and gas with so-called renewables, and a blind spot about the role that nuclear power could play, which is, after all, a renewable. But I don't think that means that we just have to resign ourselves to the net zero climate alarmist agenda. I think let's try and organise. Let's try and have a referendum about net zero, James. Let's try and persuade the public that it's not in their interest to immiserate themselves to pursue this pointless goal, given that no other countries around the world, or very few other countries around the world, including India and China and Brazil, will be pursuing it. And given the fact that the link between carbon emissions and global warming, to my mind at any rate, has yet to be definitively proved. So I think we can fight back. We're fighting back. I think we agree about the undesirability of this agenda and the lack of any robust science behind, wind power and other renewables. But what we disagree about is whether it can be stopped. I think it can, but you, I think, are too despairing.
Because the system is broken. There is no recourse for the majority who just actually want to be able to get around the country, drive their cars. They just want to be able to heat their homes using traditional, cheap, reliable fossil fuels rather than bat-chomping, bird-slicing eco-crucifix. It's not an option on the table because the Uniparty has decided that Keir Starmer is Rishi Sunak, is the new Hamza Yousaf, the new...
Yeah, but we should talk about that briefly.
Nutcase in charge of Scotland now. I mean, replacing the previous nutcase, cranky woman.
Yeah, but actually, surely that's all to the good. We should be celebrating Hamza Yousaf's triumph because there couldn't be a kind of worse exponent of the separatist cause in Scotland. Nothing could be better for unionism than Hamza Yousaf becoming the leader of the SNP, particularly as there's now likely to be a legal challenge over the integrity of the leadership election, given that he was always the continuity candidate. And we've now discovered that actually more of the same might not be a good thing for the SNP because they have 30,000 fewer members than was originally claimed by the now resigned CEO of the party, also happens to be Nicola Sturgeon's husband, at the beginning of this electoral contest. So you can see there could be a successful legal challenge, and that will mean having to rerun the leadership contest. The SNP is now going to be in turmoil for, many months to come. So this is just fantastic news, I think.
It's always could, may, might. That Rishi Sunak says there may be a case for possibly considering action at some future date, or there could possibly be in the future some legal action which might delay the inevitable for a few months. I'm not buying it.
Well, I think better Hamza than the other two candidates, both of which I think would have been better. I think Nicola Sturgeon, although not as good as Alex Salmond at his peak, not as skillful a politician, not as good a communicator, nevertheless is pretty good. There's now been a really significant decline, I think, if you compare Hamza Yousaf to Nicola Sturgeon. And it's partly the consequence of running Scotland like a one-party state. Stalin is now dead. And in order to preserve his authority, Stalin didn't cultivate any successors. There isn't any bench strength in the SNP, just as there's very little in the Labour Party, but it's particularly apparent in the SNP. They're fishing in a very shallow talent pool. I don't think the party's going to survive. I think there'll be various splits, and there are already two separatist parties in Scotland. I'm sure there'll be a third one soon. And, it looks like the separatist cause is just in its death throes, which is surely, if you're a unionist, a good thing.
You're trying to settle the point of precedency between a Louse and a Flea Tobes. They're all the same. They're all useless. They're all these sort of bad actors who are there to distract us with their despicable antics, and that's it. I don't pay any attention to this stuff anymore. It's just a distraction.
Okay. Did you see the mobbing of Kelly J. Keane in New Zealand? I don't know if you saw some of that footage.
Posey,
it was pretty disturbing.
Posey Parker.
Posey Parker, known as I said it a second ago, and now it slipped out of my mind. Anyway, yeah.
Kelly J. Keene. They think they're women.
Someone emptied a tomato ketchup bottle over her head and had her security, had she not had private security, she might well have been killed, if not badly injured, by this particular group of protesters. I mean, they were unbelievably violent and feral. She was immediately kind of whisked from the scene by the police and taken to the airport and put on a plane and sent home. I thought it was, in some ways, a very revealing moment. The woke authoritarians claim to be, you know, the nice people, the compassionate people, the people on the side of inclusion and making people feel safe and accepted. But beneath that veneer of sweetness, there is this brutal kind of almost fascistic authoritarian intolerance of anyone who challenges their dogma. And I thought, you know, the more often that, I mean, well done for Kelly J. Keene for exposing it. And the more often that can happen, I think the sooner the kind of woke cult will begin to recede. But I think that is the woke cult's Achilles heel. A lot of people are attracted to it because they think it's nice. It's all about making people feel included, about helping disadvantaged minorities, about creating a more diverse, healthier, more respectful society. And yet when they see its exponents engaging in this kind of brutal, iron-fisted censorship, the veil is whisked aside, and they realise it's a horrible Maoist cult, which has very little going for it. So I thought that was a great coup on her part, even though it must have been very unpleasant to trigger that kind of reaction. But I think it'll make it harder for the trans rights activists to advance their agenda.
Yeah. I don't know where this exactly has come from, because I don't really understand. For people of our generation, it's quite difficult to comprehend why a chap would decide that he wants to be that he wants to be a woman. Probably not to the extent of actually having a sex change, but just kind of passing as a woman. Because a lot of them look like blokes still, don't they? Blokes in dresses. And not only that, but that would then want to get into vicious cat fights, dog fights, depending on what gender they decide they are, with women who are actual women, and they get violent. I don't understand what the mentality of these people are. And I think that the culture that's encouraged them is repellent, and by the culture I mean organizations like the BBC. I mean, in the days when I used to do mainstream media stuff, I certainly went on at least one BBC program where it was me with some pretty man who was actually dressed looking like a girl, you know, I mean quite nice looking girl, because a lot, you know, some of these men are they have the sort of androgynous looks, which would previously made them a very good gay man. And now they've got this sort of feminine charm, and they're the youth on their side. But these are presented as something more than that, as figureheads for what a sort of new way of looking at the world, as a brave movement. They've taken the great courage to decide that they are in fact a girl and to go around a girl. I don't think it requires much courage, and I don't understand why they've been promoted, because it's not like when I drive shopping, it's not like everyone I look around me is thinking, if only there were more transgender people around, if only we gave them more attention. They're a fraction of a minority in the country, and yet they've been bigged up into be something they're not. It's weird.
Yeah, well, in the most recent UK, no, I think census in England and Wales, people were asked for the first time whether they identified as a gender which was at odds with their birth gender. And And it turned out that only 0.5% of the population does. But if you drill down into the data, some of those were, you know, the equivalent of spoiled ballot papers. It was more like 0.4%. So 0.2% trans women, 0.2% trans men. It's extraordinary how, you know, politics in Britain, in America, across the Anglosphere has been poleaxed by this question, you know, what is a woman? Should trans women be able to compete with biological women in women's sports? And should they be able to enter women's changing rooms? Should they be housed in women's prisons? I mean, the political class has been wrestling with these questions for something like 5 years now. And we're talking about, you know, for the most part, because it's mainly about trans women, not about trans men, 0.2% of the population. I don't know if I mentioned this before, James, but I wrote a Spectator piece about this and said that given how successful, you know, the trans lobbyists have been, you know, every toilet in every institution in the United Kingdom now has essentially been changed at enormous expense to the taxpayer to accommodate trans women, even though they are 0.2% of the population. What about men who suffer from shy bladder syndrome? They surely are a much higher percentage. These are men who can't wee if they fear that other men are overlooking them when they've got their todgers out. Must be a much higher percentage of the population than trans women, and yet they've been ignored for millennia. But along come this energetic lobby group, and suddenly everything changes. Politics is disrupted like it has been by no other issue in the same sort of time period. I mean, it's extraordinary. I suggested in The Spectator that, you know, they should hire out their services as lobbyists to other people, other tiny minorities who've been complaining that society hasn't accommodated them, isn't making enough of an allowance for them, like dyslexics, for instance. You know, why not change every road sign? I mean, the number of dyslexics must be huge compared to the number of, you know, trans people. So it is extraordinary how effective they've been. But if you look at the activists in New Zealand in some of the video footage, for the most part, the people attacking Kelly J. Keene weren't trans women. They were big, hulking, great male allies of the LGBTQ plus community. So it's sort of like, well, why are they doing that? Why are they kind of viciously attacking, you know, a single lone women's rights campaigner? And it's hard to suppress the suspicion that actually it's just an excuse to attack a woman. You know, they can indulge their kind of most primitive, misogynistic, sadistic impulses and physically assault a woman in public and tell themselves at the same time that they're being virtuous by doing that. They're performing a useful public service, and often do it certainly without the interference of the authorities, if not the blessing of the authorities. We saw the same thing on a smaller scale happening in Hyde Park yesterday. So there was a pro-women's rights protest, and it was mobbed by trans rights allies, trans rights activists and their allies. But it's the allies, these vicious, unpleasant, you know, black masked men, the same people who've been tearing up cities in France over the past couple of weeks over Macron's railroading through of the rise in the retirement age from 62 to 64. It's these really unpleasant, for the most part, left-wing young men who any excuse to just break things, set fire to things and attack women.
Yes. Do you think we should do another ad before we then...
Let's do another ad and then do Culture Corner. Yeah.
Okay. If you're responsible for a business and for commercial or buy-to-let property, you're probably keeping a weather eye on the economy right now. Enter Dan Gaskin, London Calling listener and owner of Crest Mortgages. Dan is an ex-Royal Navy warfare officer who has bought and sold companies and thrives on making sure you are financially protected and provided for. Whether you are Team Toby or Team James, Dan will help you navigate through stormy economic seas. Dan is also interested in networking with fellow established business owners in order to find out opportunities to work with people looking for investment in their company or are looking to implement their exit strategy. To talk through commercial and financial challenges in complete confidence, call 0116 502 3000. And do please connect at www.linkedin.com/in/Dan Gaskin. And to be FCA compliant, Crest Mortgages is the trading style of Epiphany Investments Limited, which is an appointed representative of the Open Work Partnership, a trading style of Open Work Limited, which is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. We choose to be part of the Open Work Partnership and award-winning network. Your house may be repossessed if you do not keep up with repayments on your mortgage.
So, James, have you seen anything?
Well, I have.
You have?
I've seen the first episode of Succession.
Oh, you haven't?
I have.
I'm really jealous. So I wanted to watch that yesterday. I thought in America, the debut was Sunday. But in the UK, of course, we have to wait 24 hours unless you're somebody special, in which case you got it on DVD or something.
I got it. Well, I got the modern equivalent of DVD, where you have to go through this incredibly tedious process to get through the Warner Brothers system. And it took me 45 minutes just to pass all the tests to get. And then I couldn't work out how to get the sound properly on my going through the TV rather than my computer. Well, I did later on. But the point is that for the first half, I was listening. I could barely hear the dialogue. And, we all go deaf at this age. And you know how important dialogue is on Succession. I mean, it's the thing that makes it so good.
Could you not put the subtitles up?
I wouldn't have known how to do that. I didn't think I had that option, but I agree. Wherever possible, I watch with subtitles now.
Me too. I used to kind of be slightly hesitant about turning on the subtitles for fear that it was like, giving in to old age and we ought to strain and try and hear what the characters are saying and not just kind of take the easy road. But actually, I don't think it's a generational thing. Even my kids prefer to watch things now with subtitles.
Totally. I think in the case of Jesse Armstrong, we have a duty to not miss any bit of dialogue, because it is actors these days are much less better at articulating, aren't they, than they were, because they probably haven't had the stage training. They haven't been to the RSC and been taught by whatever her name was, so they mumble anyway, and the joy about Succession, because I mean the thing that one would hate Succession to be is a thing about who inherits a media empire. But it's not really about that at all. It's just about how rich people live, how very, very rich people live, how they get in and out of helicopters, how they travel everywhere by private jet, the sort of thing they get up to in their private lives, how messed up they are, which is great. The business aspect, you think about it. If what's it called, Logan Roy? If Logan Roy were really this titan of media and entertainment that the series pretends he is, the organization would be going from strength to strength. But actually, it should have closed down in season one, because he's just a sort of blustering bully. His kids are all absolutely useless. And when it gets farmed out to somebody like Matthew McFadden character, Tom Worms, how do you pronounce his surname, or Greg even. The idea that branches of this supposedly world-beating company are being run by the likes of Greg and Tom is just absurd. But I love that about it. It's not really about business. It's about snappy dialogue and helicopters.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love it too, and I agree. You don't want to miss a word of the writing because it's so good. One of the reasons I think the reason people like it the reason they think they like it isn't the real reason they like it. I think the reason they think they like it is because they style themselves radical critics of, late stage capitalism and the neoliberal globalist agenda. And they like this kind of waspish, acidic portrait of our kind of media overlords. But actually, the real reason they like it, I think, is not because it kind of... They think it's going to foment revolution. They like it because they can kind of reassure themselves that these unbelievably rich and privileged people are actually really unhappy. And that being this powerful, this successful, this rich, having this kind of access to power and celebrities is actually just a recipe for lifelong misery. And I think it's sort of a source of comfort. It comforts the afflicted by making them feel that they're better off, you know, not being part of that ghastly, corrupt three-ring circus. So I think there is a slight disconnect between why people think they like it and why they applaud it and what the real reason it appeals to them so much.
I don't know. I don't get that vibe of it. I mean, obviously they're all deeply messed up and repellent, but it's not, I don't really feel that it's selling us the message that, look, you can have all the money in the world and still be unhappy. I think it makes a very attractive case for being fantastically rich. The life they lead is amazing. The locations are sumptuous. That you don't watch Succession and thinking, oh, I'm so much happier with my impoverished life. So I'm not sure I quite buy the thesis that they are messed up independently of their helicopters and mansions and
no
and
I think part of their being messed up is they're all scrabbling for kind of a slice of the pie and to fill Logan Roy's shoes when he eventually shuffles off his mortal coil. That's one of the slightly implausible things about the series is, like, you know, you could see the premise of the show in the title is who's going to succeed Logan Roy. And he was sort of dying and about to kick his clogs in season one. And because it was so successful, they've decided to kind of extend his life seemingly indefinitely. He's made a complete recovery by the looks of it, hasn't he? I don't know. I haven't watched the whole of...
Well, he has. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think... episode one, season one, he was on his last legs. I mean,
on his last legs, yeah.
He has an episode. And you think, well, is he going to survive the night? And probably Jesse Armstrong, when he had the first series commission, was by no means certain there was going to be another one.
Yeah.
So, but this happens with all these series, doesn't it? If they can squeeze out another three or four seasons.
Brian Cox is getting on a bit. I was slightly worried that the actor might die before they killed off the character, and then they'd be in a pickle.
Well, he's killed himself now. I think he's decided he doesn't want to do any more.
This is the last season, isn't it? Yeah,
it is. Which is really sad because I don't think it really mattered the story arc about whether or not who gets to inherit the company, because it's not about that. It's about the parties. You think about all the really memorable moments of Succession, apart from the dialogue. Any scene involving Greg and Tom, who are the real stars, because it's just comedy. Because I don't think Jesse Armstrong's really interested in big business, really. What he likes is there's a great scene. I don't want to spoil it for you too much, but where Greg shags somebody that he's brought along to Logan Roy's party. and then he's advised by Tom that he needs to fess up to Logan because it will have been recorded on security camera. It's just ridiculous, but really, really funny. So there are those scenes. And then there are the set pieces. And I still think the best set piece was the mother, the Harriet Walter at Eastnor Castle, that party where Greg is trying, no, sorry, Kendall is trying to score some drugs. And he goes off with one of the waiters and it ends up inadvertently drowning this guy. But the whole, it's so well done, all that. Or the boar hunt.
Yeah.
No, I love it. I think it's one of the best things I've ever seen on TV.
It's up there with, I think it's, top six shows of all time. I had a rather less happy experience. I've watched the first two episodes of The Night. Is it I think it's called The Night Watchman. But that can't be right. That now doesn't sound right.
It's
a new series on Netflix, and it's called the Night Manager. And it's
about Le Carré.
I know, it's got the same name as as I think it's got the same name as the Le Carré series, but it's actually about a kind of low-level FBI agent who picks up the phone when he's kind of manning the phone in this kind of operations emergency center. And he's contacted by this young woman in distress, and he has to go and kind of rescue her. And in the course of rescuing her, kind of stumbles across this kind of conspiracy involving the FBI, the Secret Service, the president. And I thought it sounded, I like those kind of paranoid, you know, 3 Days of the Condor style conspiracy thrillers. And so I kind of leapt on it, but it's quite kind of lowbrow. And it's at the lower end of that kind of conspiracy thriller spectrum. I think Rabbit Hole sounds more promising. I don't know if you've seen any trailers for Rabbit Hole.
Oh, no. Is that on Netflix as well?
No, that's on Paramount Plus. And I think it's tipped me over the edge. Your praise of the Tulsa King, plus the fact that you can get all the series of Yellowstone, as well as the two prequels on Paramount Plus, and now Rabbit Hole as well, I think, because made me think I'm going to subscribe to yet another streaming service, but I don't know whether to subscribe to UK Paramount Plus or US Paramount Plus, and I don't even know if there's any difference between them. But I can subscribe to either one because of my setup here.
I think that when the accountants unravel my estate, they're going to find that the reason I went bankrupt is because of all these TV sites that I've signed up to and then forgotten about, and they've been on direct debit ever since, because I'm certainly signed up to Paramount Plus. I think I'm signed up to Disney. Apple TV, do I pay for that? Probably, I don't know.
Probably do if you watch Slow Horses.
And I never remember to claim my expenses from The Spectator, who are probably completely tight-assed anyway about paying out for this stuff, even though they should. But yeah, it's expensive, but if expensive. We've got the excuse that we've got Culture Corner, and I'm a TV critic, so I have to watch this stuff.
Quite a good excuse, yeah. So Rabbit Hole looks quite promising, doesn't it? It's another paranoid conspiracy thriller.
I like the title. It could be about me, couldn't it?
It could be, yeah. But I think it's probably closer to Team James than Team Toby in his explanation of recent events, judging from the trailer. Keith Sutherland's in it, Charles Dance. It looks pretty highbrow. Not highbrow, but it looks to be of higher quality, bigger budget, better writing than The Night Manager.
Yeah, I think I'm going to watch that. That's next on my list. Definitely.
Okay. Well, that's the only new thing I've watched, I think, since we last spoke. I've just started listening to, I finished Sharp's Waterloo and have started listening to Royal Flash, which is the second in the Flashman novels by George MacDonald Fraser. And it's very good. It's very funny. He's a very good writer, George MacDonald Fraser.
He is. Sorry, can I ask you a question about Trollope?
Yes.
Did you listen to the first in the Palliser series?
Yes, I did.
Can you forgive her?
Yes.
Do you share my irritation with I think the hunting scenes are fantastic. I think that his portrait of the pursuit of money and the class system is matchless. But his central characters are just dire. You're not rooting for any of them. I mean, that stupid girl, what's he called? Alice. She's a pain. And George Vavasor, he's a pain. Mr. Palace, or whatever his name is, he's a bore. The flighty girl, the heiress who marries him, she's just a bit of a dipstick. I'm not rooting for any of these people. I don't really care about them.
Yeah, I think he was a pretty fearful snob. And you do need, I think, to share his snobbish fascination with the kind of most glamorous, richest, aristocratic kind of class of his era.
Oh, but I love all that. It's just the characters. Like, what's her motivation? Why should we care about this girl who can't make up her mind whether to marry this boring man in Cambridge with a nice house and a nice garden, or whether to marry this kind of tosser with a scar across his face who doesn't really love her. He just wants her money for his for his stupid political career. I mean, what kind of heroine is that? Give me Lizzie Bennett any day, or
so you thought she was too passive, and just kind of the plaything of
the combination of sort of passivity, high-mindedness, indecision. Just I couldn't recognise her as a human type, or certainly not a type that I wanted to spend any time with.
That's interesting. I don't recall being particularly irritated by the central characters. I do remember the hunting scene, and I think his depiction of
is there any one?
The English class system or the hunting scenes. But I thought the heiress was kind of quite sympathetic. She is a bit flighty, and she makes terrible errors of judgment. She's initially dazzled, isn't she, by this kind of good-looking young swain who turns out to be a complete loser and less impressed. I mean, always the kind of running theme, in fact, of all Trollope's novels. I mean, they always have this kind of they're essentially romantic comedies, aren't they? And it's all about, you know, whether the woman will choose the right man over the wrong man, in the same way that Jane Austen's novels are about the same thing. But you know, it's always about not being dazzled by the, you know, exterior, not judging a book by its cover, but kind of being able to see that the kind of duller quarter is the more honourable, more worthy partner than the kind of dazzling young blade. But that's sort of, I mean, I quite like this. It's sort of, you know, it's one of the kind of five great plots, but I quite like it. I'm always kind of sucked in, and I'm always kind of willing the female character to kind of choose the nice man and not run off with the bad one. Anyway,
when my wife first read War and Peace as a young woman, she just skipped
as a teenager.
She skipped past all the war bits because she found them boring. Although she did appreciate them later on when she reread the book. But I feel a bit like that with Trollope, that I just want to read the hunting scenes and the kind of the ball scenes maybe, and just skip past the romance, which is just tedious.
But I remember that the next one in the series, which is about, I think the central character is an Irish politician. I remember there's even more hunting in number two in the Palliser series. So you've got that to look forward to, James.
That's good. I should probably go now because it's my Pilates approaching. I need to eat some porridge before I go. So
okay. All right, well, good to talk to you, as always. Right. And next week, I will have seen episode one of Succession.
Yeah, you will. You can give me your unique take. All right.
I will. Okay.
Okay, cool. Right, bye.
This is London Calling.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.